Listen to WGN Radio's newest podcast, Behind the Badge, Illinois, hosted by David Hochberg. Behind the Badge, Illinois views current events through the eyes of Illinois law enforcement leaders. Tune in. Visit WGNradio.com/behindthebadge.
Thinking big thoughts, so you don't have to.
The living.
Here's John Williams.
How are you? This is John. We're in the Allstate Skyline Studio weekdays from 1 to 3. Saturdays from 10 a.m. till noon on social media. Search for me on WGN King John. I posted over the weekend a couple of things you might enjoy. A poem about February and video of me from about 30 years ago. Doing a commercial for a shopping center in Peoria, Illinois with my then 2-year-old son, Grant. And it's amazing on many fronts. I remember the day we recorded that commercial for a shopping center in Peoria, Illinois called the Metro Center. I was working for a local radio station, had a little kid. They said, hey, you've got a little kid, and we need to do a TV commercial for Valentine's Day. So how about you be the dad shopping with the son for mom? I remember when we did the commercial, I thought I looked good, sounded good, and acted well. It hasn't held up over the years, I got to be honest with you. Meanwhile, I remember that day my son, who was always very agreeable and cooperative and just had a nice way about him, it was one of those days where he wasn't all of that, and it was really frustrating to record the commercial. But looking back, I think Grant did fine. He did well. I did not. And somebody posted that in Peoria, and then it whipped around Facebook to the point where I said, okay, I've got to share this thing too. So if you like me on Facebook, you'll be able to find at WGN King John the step back in time in 3, 2, 1. Okay, if you're Kanye West and you have unlimited resources, I mean, first of all, you're Kanye West. You don't need Kenny G, but you can get Kenny G to do this in the living room amidst a sea of vases and roses. For your wife, that's a nice touch. But I think that would be a nice touch if I did that for Brenda, or Steve did it for Sharon. You know, somebody who, we're not celebrities, and if we had Kenny G come, wow, now that's something. But if you're Kanye West, you could have got kind of anybody on earth, including yourself, to do something like this. If I'm Kim Kardashian, I come out and go, really, Kenny G? Seriously? And then what do you do with him afterwards? You know that movie, the documentary films that were made about the Fyre Festival, F-Y-R-E, Fyre
Finally
Fest?
Watched both of them.
What did you think?
Oh, they were fantastic, but that guy, something else.
What a pathological liar he is.
Yeah, right?
So the only reason I bring that up right now is because Fyre Fest was a music fest on a whole nother level that was supposed to happen a couple of years ago, and they took thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars from people who wanted to go to the festival, but they never executed it. The man that threw the festival is now in jail and fined $25 million. And even when he was out on parole, that is, he was arrested, and then pending his trial, he was released. And while he was released, he started a whole nother scam, which is just a little footnote kind of at the end of the movie, but is maybe one of the most jaw-dropping things about the whole film. But his reason for having this Fyre Festival was to promote an app. The app was called F-Y-R-E. I don't remember exactly if it just called Fyre or Fyre App or whatever it was, but that was the company. And the Fyre App did this. If, say, you're rich enough and you want to get Kenny G to perform for your wife on Valentine's Day, you've heard about these sorts of things where celebrities sometimes appear at private functions. How does that happen? The app was designed to do that. And may yet be a good idea. I mean, there's a market for this. If Kenny G tells his agent, listen, I'll do a bar mitzvah for $5 million. I mean, you would do a bar mitzvah. Maybe you would. Then your name is on the app. And if I've got a kid and I've got a lot of money and I want to throw her the best 16th birthday ever, I go on there and I just look at the celebrities. And it's sort of like dating. If I swipe and you swipe, we're hooked up and suddenly we have contact information, me to your agent maybe, and next thing you know, there's a tent in my backyard, and there's Kenny G? Okay, but at least that's the idea. You know, that there is a market for that out there. I don't think Kanye West needed that. He could just... I'm kind of surprised Kanye picked Kenny G. End of conversation.
So I think that Kim is maybe a couple of years older than I am. But when I was a little kid, Kenny G was like the ultimate. Like, dad bought his music for mom and they listened to it. So I can see that as being like the original romance that you knew about when you were a kid.
If you did a multiple choice quiz for me and you said Kanye purchased the services of this artist to perform in home for Kim, and then you had four choices and one of them was Kenny G, if the other two or three were the Easter Bunny and Santa Claus, I still would not have picked Kenny G. I just that is not the guy I thought he was going to hire. We were at the Garfield Conservatory yesterday. Have you guys been there lately?
I've never been there.
You know, it was snowing the last couple of days. It's been cold. It's February, right? You go there and it's humid and it's dirt and it's beautiful plants and it's free. Brenda and I walked around that thing for about an hour and a half. You walk into a desert room. You know, it's just like the world's largest greenhouse, right? But there's a room with cactus and these amazing giant plants. Then you go to another one, and it's kind of a tropical, you know, fern feel. But you can just carry your coat because it's warm and it's amazing. It's just such a nice getaway.
Is it bigger than the Lincoln Park one?
Haven't been to the Lincoln Park one ever or in such a long time, I don't have an answer to that.
Huh. Well, then you go to that one and I'll go to Garfield Park.
Yeah, no kidding. You've been to the one at Lincoln Park, huh?
Yeah.
Now, what a good idea, right? And this was a lot of fun. Jacqueline Jackson and Congressman Jesse Jackson Jr. are going to be in our studio in a little bit. Also on the show today, we'll talk about the law in Illinois that says if you have a gun and then you're convicted of a crime and lose your right to have the gun, you lose your license, you lose the validity, say, of your FOID card. But what happens to the gun? You're supposed to turn it in. The cops are supposed to get it. What happens to the gun? In the case in Aurora, that guy had the gun, but nobody ever came to get it. And I don't know how we manage that. But, you know, you always think, well, if you have a felony, you can't go get a gun. But what if you already have one and then you commit the crime? I'm going to talk about that loophole, if you will, in the law with somebody who knows more about it than I do in the 2 o'clock hour. And the Jussie Smollett stories in the news today, we'll deal a little bit with that. Also, Thomas Jefferson, third president of the United States, will say hi at 2 o'clock right after that news. But Jesse Jackson Jr. and his mom will be in our studio after 1:30. So while he was in jail for a couple of years for illegally using campaign funds, remember, while he was in jail, his mother wrote him a letter every single day. And it was as much to keep him connected with the world. It was good therapy for her. And it was to remind him that he's not forgotten. But if you had to write a letter to your son or daughter every single day to do that, what do you do? We don't write letters anymore. And it sounds like she wasn't sending email. In fact, I'm just about certain of it. I'll ask him about that and if they'd considered it. But they would talk about mail call in the prison. And they would hand Jesse his letters. And he felt bad because sometimes other guys didn't get any mail. And he would always have a letter from his mom as well as other mail that would come into him. And it would be chatty stuff. November 25th, 2013. Dear son, my day began very early. I had to be at grandparents' day at 7:30 for Yusuf Jr. Of course, I was late and I forgot my glasses. When you forget your glasses and can't see, people think you're illiterate. So always keep your glasses with you. Once you've explained you don't have your glasses with you and ask someone to read the name on the bottle or the instructions on the wall, they read it to you slowly and then pause and ask if you understand what they read. Maybe because I'm old and can't see. Young people think I'm crazy. They ask, are you out of yourself? They ask, are you out by yourself? Are you alone? Should I call someone for you? I started to stop by the pancake house at breakfast, but received a call to return home. The people working on my house were outside, and I needed access to the inside and needed access to the inside of the house. They bang along all day. I think I told you I sent a contribution to Pastor Singleton's church. I like his and Reverend Winston's ministries. Mom. It's just a bunch of letters like that. But it's just such an interesting, I don't know, if I read anybody's letters, I think it would be an interesting insight into what their life is like. This one is really noteworthy. She went to Washington, D.C. by train. And when this would have been after her train trip. So she gets off the train and she writes a letter. that gives you such an insight into how different someone's life can be from yours. It's not a long letter, but I just thought it was one of the best. By the way, this texter, 630, says, yep, Garfield Park is bigger as conservatories go. About writing letters to family members, John, I was in the Marine Corps for over 11 years, and I got a letter from my father every single day, even if it was just a couple of lines telling me how proud he was of me, but I always had a letter. That's interesting. I think that's a lost art. An email, they're not the same, although even that would be something for a lot of us. 219 says, maybe Kim has told Kanye that Kenny is her favorite musician. Maybe so. 219, Kenny G is our version of Maroon 5. You really love him or you really hate him. I think that letter writer is onto something because I like Maroon 5. I have no problem with any of them. But as we learned at the Super Bowl before, during, and after, and we knew this before. We knew this before going into the Super Bowl. Some people do not like Maroon 5.
Like me.
I got bad news for you, too. I watched Bohemian Rhapsody over the weekend. I thought it was pretty terrible, Elif.
What?
Agree to disagree.
I thought it was... we talked about this a little on my Saturday show. I won't dwell on it. And I want to get to Jacqueline Jackson's letter here. But Brenda said after the movie, that was a really good Lifetime movie. And I felt the same way. And I hate it when snobby people go, oh, your movie is not so good. But it wasn't so good.
So is this because you actually know of Queen and know their story and know all about Freddie Mercury?
No. What do you have? Well, it sure looks airbrushed, number one. The story does look very cooperative for the members of the band. The writing isn't that good. Here's where I got off the bus. The scene where their bus breaks down. Don't all rock and roll band movies have a scene where the car breaks down and they get out and change the tire and argue about the band?
Yeah.
They had that scene in the movie. Even if that happened in real life, they shouldn't have put it in the movie. It's so cliche.
The cool thing was to we watched the movie and then went on YouTube and watched the actual Live Aid performance.
That's exactly what I did.
Yeah, a lot of people have. I've said that to others and they all say that too.
And I'll tell you what, the last 10 minutes of the movie is the best part of the movie. It saves the movie for me to the degree that that thing can be saved. But I mean, the last 10 minutes of the movie where they do the Live Aid concert is lockstep in sync with the actual concert. And Robbie Malek is good in that, don't you think, Steve?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, he's dynamite, at least in that last 10 minutes. But if that wins Best Picture of the Year, I'm done. It's over.
I'm just getting started.
We can still be friends.
Yeah, and when you said that about Brenda earlier, it was like a knife in my heart.
I know. I shouldn't have said that for Brenda's sake and for yours, because I know you like and appreciate my wife, and she feels good about you. I think this is just going to have to be something that's in between all of us and doesn't damage our friendship. Sort of like the way Steve and I feel about Butler and Marquette.
It's the way I feel about it. I'm not sure you do feel that way, but...
It is in between us, and that's about me, Steve. So in Jacqueline Jackson's book, Loving You, Thinking of You, Don't Forget to Pray, Letters to My Son in Prison. On page 60, she writes this letter to him, December 5th, 2013. I arrived in Washington. She left Chicago. I think that's her point of origination. She went to Washington, D.C. She went by train. My son, I have arrived in Washington. I am now more tired than I was when I got on the train. This trip was a ride through hell. An old white man, an ex-Navy SEAL, got mad because he couldn't figure out which door to exit so he could get off to smoke. So he took a seat next to a white woman to complain, became very familiar, felt her breast, and all hell broke loose. He was subdued at the lower car by the conductors and a male passenger who discovered the ex-Navy SEAL had a pistol in his pocket as they held him on the floor of the car. The train stopped. The police were there outside of Toledo to receive him. He went into their car without handcuffs. Now, I can tell you, I have seen with my own eyes black men less violent on the train who were roughed up, handcuffed, and arrested, and they were not armed with a firearm. There is a difference. Then a young grandma behind me with her grandson by her 21-year-old daughter who got pregnant, decided to have the baby while unmarried, talked on the phone to her boyfriend the whole way to Washington, D.C. She asked me to babysit twice because she needed a break. I obliged. My, my, my. If this wasn't enough to drive me crazy, an obnoxious man sat across from me and wanted to know if I was spoken for. I am home, tired, just heard about Mandela, and saw you with him on TV while in South Africa for his release. Betty Magnus's grandson, shot 7 times on the way to the store. He didn't make it. I love you, Mom. Think of all the things that are in that letter. The two of them are in our studio. John Williams here in the Allstate Skyline Studio. Congressman Jesse Jackson Jr. is here. Jacqueline L. Jackson, his mother, is here too. The book that I guess you'd say they've co-published is Loving You, Thinking of You, Don't Forget to Pray, Letters to My Son in Prison. I read from some of Jacqueline's letters just before the news. If you're new to Chicago, Congressman Jackson went to jail for a couple of years for improperly using campaign funds, served his time, and while he was in jail, his mother wrote him a letter every single day, which we didn't know about. Both of you, welcome to the studio.
Thanks for having us, John.
Oh, thank you, John.
I said co-published. Whose idea was it to publish these letters?
It was my idea. And I
think
initially,
it was April and Nicole, yeah, when you were compiling it. Let me...
Yeah. Okay, Mom,
yes,
please.
The letter...
It's your mom. You got a letter.
Well,
it's her
book. He told me, he said, I want to take you out for my birthday. And I agreed. And we went out, and he started taking pictures of me. He said, you know, I know how you hate surprises, so I guess I need to level with you.
This is your son?
My son. He said, there are so many pages of letters that you sent to me. I want to self-publish them and present them to you in the form of a book. He has some friends from A&T, his school down in North Carolina, two young ladies, sisters, and they said, well, we'll assemble them for you and kind of put the dates and get the sort them out. They were the ones who said, you can't just publish this and give it to your mother. I didn't realize somebody else was reading the
letters. When you wrote the letters, you didn't intend them for posterity or
absolutely
publication.
Absolutely not. You don't know how many we had to pull.
Did you then talk to her? Really? I mean, because there's some stuff in here that I think are going to... I won't say you burned bridges, but I think there's people reading this and going, really?
Yes,
really?
Yes.
Jacqueline, did you have
yes,
to?
Yes, yes.
John, in the self-published version, there are a lot more letters because...
Really?
My intention was just to provide one book for my mother. March 11th, 2018 was my birthday, and we were having dinner in downtown Chicago. My mother and father took me out, and I said, Mom, I was in a very dark place when I entered prison. I was ashamed. I was humiliated. I was hurt. I had fallen a long way from where I was, and my mother knew that. And quite frankly, when I left town on my way to Butner and then Montgomery.
Butner is where you were incarcerated.
Yes, sir. And I wanted to be left alone. I just didn't want any more communication because I was kind of overwhelmed. And I told my mother to leave me alone. And I think that most men incarcerated want to go through this phase of just being left alone.
Her early letters were like, are you getting these? Hello, I haven't heard from you.
And she said, I'm going to write you every day. I'm going to keep in touch with you because I'm not going to abandon you.
Did you read the letters when they came in?
I read them, and I was so overwhelmed by the number of letters that she was sending me that I began sharing them with men in prison who were receiving no letters at all, who hadn't heard from family members. And it became their connection. At mail call at 4 o'clock after the 4 o'clock count, the guard would say...
Their connection to what?
To family, to people on the outside.
Even if it's not their family?
The guard would say at 4 o'clock every day across the country in prisons all over the country, a guard yells, mail call, mail call. And he would say, Jackson, Jackson, Jackson. As all the inmates gathered, they would be gathering to receive a card, a communication, something from some loved one. And mine were just coming and coming and coming. And there were times when my head would be going up, John, and their heads would be going down. And I said, hey, wait a minute, come here. Let's see what my mama's saying today. And I would just read it to the guys. And I was so overwhelmed about a week ago when one of the men that I served with actually sent me a picture of the letters of the book that he had purchased because he remembered reading the letters
really?
In prison, and that was a connection for him. And I asked Mom if she wanted to see them beyond this, and she said, I think we can help a lot of people.
So not all of the letters were published, but you speak candidly about your relationship with your husband, about how you feel about some relatives and friends.
You're going to get me in trouble.
I didn't publish the book.
Let's let them get the book first. But what we are concerned about is the intention of the book. I'm hoping that these stories and these little letters can be shared with many of the guys who are incarcerated today. So they can, when they do get visitors, they can encourage people. A letter you can hold. A phone call disappears. You have to kind of go over what did they say. But as you see, these letters were about my condition, what I was doing, because there's no re-entry program created for guys who are incarcerated. And when they come back to the new community, especially if they've been gone 2 to 3 years, technology has changed. Many people are deceased. And they should feel a sense of belonging in that community and still connected.
Well, that's what we were talking about off the air. I said, even if you two weren't famous, you know, it's kind of interesting to sort of be the fly on the wall between your exchanges. I think it's instructive to know what would a mother say to a son in prison, or what would a parent say to an adult child in any circumstances. It's just interesting to see how other people relate to each other. And then I reflect on how I communicate with my parents or I with my kids. I don't know if you intended that. Clearly you did not. You were writing to him. And maybe when you published the book, you didn't expect that. But I think this book works on many levels. You know, it's interesting to know how people interact with each other. And that we have some of the same thoughts. Here's you on February 15th.
Oh, my goodness. Now.
Loving you always. And by the way, you begin so many letters like this. My son, don't forget to pray. Put on the full armor of God. I hope to see you this weekend if all goes well. Today I spent the entire day visiting every Walmart in the area trying to find for my mom the elastic bottom jogging pants. I've not been able to find for her therapy session a size large Fruit of the Loom jogging pants here in Washington, D.C. or Maryland. I am on my way to the hospital and I am tired.
And I had so much support. I didn't realize that's one of the letters I skipped. I didn't realize
the next, you didn't know this, this book. It's really interesting. And then the next day you write, my son, you are always on my mind. How are you? Today, Mr. Corey and I searched once more for Mom's jogging pants. And I'm sure you're reading these going, oh, my God, you know, a letter from Mom, and I'm reading about Grandma's jogging pants, Fruit of the Loom Large. Really? Really? I mean, what was your reaction when you were reading the mundane like this? Did you appreciate that?
You know, I did. I did because I appreciated...
He has to know my mother.
...connectedness. And my grandmother was a very, very special lady, and I was kind of overwhelmed because of her health issues and the fact that my mother was also providing for her, and she was also trying to communicate with me, and she was trying to share with me what was actually happening in real time. And she really didn't want, she knew that I was incarcerated, she knew I was in prison, but she didn't want the prison to be in me, and she wanted to connect me to what was happening in real time on the regular. And
This stuff is in some ways is valuable, isn't it?
One of the letters I said, consider yourself a detainee, because my mother said, we don't want him to come out as a prisoner. Now, you have to talk to him, Jackie, so he doesn't come out as a prisoner. So in many ways, I was trying to prepare him to come out with his head up. If you've served your time, you should be expunged. And you should be on with your life. You should be able to go back to school and find housing and lead a life and contribute to society. So that's what I wanted my son to do. And while visiting the prisons, there's so many intelligent and bright young people there.
Yeah.
And we have to think about what are we going to do with all this talent.
Mama, let me share something with you that I don't know if you fully appreciate was actually also one of the realities of your letters. I read and had read many times, but I read again in prison Viktor Frankl's book, Man's Search for Meaning. And here he objectively is looking at what's taking place in the context of Auschwitz and confinement. And he talked about objectification. So when I had a job in prison mopping, I would mop required once a day, but I would mop three or four times a day because the opportunity to use the mop and to dance with the mop was like dancing with my wife. It was like being outside of the prison. It was being outside of yourself for that moment. I was listening the other day, John, when some people were making fun of Bill Cosby in prison as Dr. Huxtable. Well, there are men in prison who've only known him as Dr. Huxtable, and they've never had health care. So a certain unreality becomes reality. While cleaning the bathroom one day in prison, Mom, a young man had been transferred, actually an older gentleman had been transferred from carpentry to the restroom detail. And he said, "Congressman, will you call President Obama and tell him that they need to move me back to carpentry? Now you got access." And I'm sitting there looking at him like, man, I'm here with you. I don't have access to anyone. But in his mind, he was in prison with a congressman.
Mm-hmm. Well, this letter was a reality check, or these letters
were a reality check.
I suspect were a reality check for these people. I want to just ask you to comment, Jacqueline, on this. July 13th, 2014, it's late in the book, so relatively later in your incarceration, and halfway through that letter that begins, "My son, how are you? I hope all is well. Today was a very good day. We thank God for you, and we all prayed for your safety at Operation Push at a meeting." And then down towards the middle, you write, "Jesse, we are not the reason you are here. As a matter of fact, we've always tried to save you from others and yourself. This time, you were too far away. This was your choice. Well, good news. I bought you some fishing lures from a house sale. I hope you remember Dr. Hurst, president of Malcolm X College. The people who live there now are moving away and have as much stuff as I have. I'll save the lures, about 100 of them, until you return. Perhaps we can fry the fish you catch with them and add some grits and cheese for breakfast. I miss you so much. I love you all the time. I love you, Mom." But when you said, "As a matter of fact, we tried to save you from others and yourself, you are there, this was your choice," what were you talking about?
Well,
do you remember specifically what you were talking about?
We are on a journey. My son had become a congressman, and he was in another life with new responsibilities.
In jail, you mean?
No, when he was in Congress.
Prior to incarceration.
So we were kind of distant at that time because his life was not like ours. We had an organization that we were serving, and he had a political life in Washington, D.C. And oftentimes, and sometimes we even disagreed with positions that that were taken, but he would say to us, "Honestly, you don't know what the body is like, and sometimes you have to compromise. You give a little on this, and you take a little on that." Being an activist, you know, most activists know nothing but charge. We're street fighters, you know. No matter what this day is, the storm, we're sitting out somewhere. That's a different life from people who make decisions being in a room together.
Yeah.
So that created some distance and oftentimes some misunderstandings. So we've been going at it and coming back, but we agreed to disagree with each other. We could still have Thanksgiving, Christmas, and the children over. But sometimes the lines were drawn in the sand, like most families. The problem with most families, they can't come back together and agree to move on. So when I made the statement, I was saying, you have a responsibility for your life where you were, where this happened. And you must assume the responsibility for it.
Was that hard for you to hear, or were you on the same page when you read that?
I think again, I was in a dark place, and I accepted responsibility for my behavior. I had been convicted of spending about $75,000 a year for 10 years beyond my means, and I had to reflect upon it, the shame of it all, the embarrassment of it all. I thought I was doing a pretty good job as a congressman. I had rarely missed a vote.
A bad politician.
I had rarely missed a vote. And, you know, my mother and I have gone back and forth on, you know, the advantages and the disadvantages of what living in two cities means, having children and trying to operate a household and also maintain a certain expectation and quality of life. Those are all my errors, and I accept fully the shortcomings of my ways.
And
it was painful.
That's why I love you.
What? Because I'm candid, honest about it. I did
that's
wrong.
That's why I love you.
Well, thank you, Mom.
This is the young man I want to see.
I don't have anything to hide.
Kisses.
No. Last time I kissed you, it ended up on television, and I said I had lipstick on. No, I'm not doing that anymore.
You know we're on the radio right now.
Right? Yes, I sure do.
It's 151 on WGN. Speaking of all of that, though, we'll pause here, and I just want you two to address one more thing. And that was a point in the book a couple of times, but not too much. I sort of respected the restraint you showed in your writing the letters to your son, or maybe in your editing of them and not including it all. But there is a point, though, where you talk to him about marriage and about the need to keep the family together for the sake of the children, if not for the husband and wife. Says it's something you've learned and something he needs to appreciate. And I'd like your reflections on that in a minute. Jesse Jackson Jr., the congressman in our studio with his mother, Jacqueline Jackson. She wrote him a letter every day he was in jail. Published now, it's titled, Loving You, Thinking of You, Don't Forget to Pray, Letters to My Son in Prison. Every day he was in jail, Jacqueline Jackson wrote a letter to her son, Jesse Jackson Jr., the, what was it, four-term congressman?
I think I was eight terms.
Pardon me.
Eight terms.
Yeah. And at one point in there, and I've highlighted it, but I'm not going to take the time to read much from it, but you talk to him about his wife coming over to visit and the kids and how he needs to get his life right for the sake of the children, if not for the marriage. Am I recollecting that correctly?
I believe that marriage is for family, and it is a business. It's a small corporation. Many of us, when they say that our wealth is accumulated in our homes and our cars and our property, there's an business institution that houses all of those things. The people who are the most vulnerable in the marriage are the children. And I believe that children should always, their welfare should be prioritized.
So if you're having trouble with your husband or you're having trouble with
your wife, and you
ever so obliquely refer to that at times in the book, and I'm like, I wonder where's she going to go next with this?
I want for clarity, he's mine, and I belong to him.
And you avow your love for and support for Jesse Sr.
56 years I've been supporting him.
Even when he's disappointed you, even when he's failed you. And you say you do this because of the children.
Well, I do this because I love him. I love him, but to love someone doesn't mean that you are taken advantage of. We have to remember we're all individuals, but I cannot allow what he does with his life to impact mine. We come together at the table as one, but when we get up, he has to make life decisions, and so do I. And I don't allow his life decisions to violate my life decisions.
I want to comment on this, Mom, because you wrote several letters where you were concerned about my children actually visiting me in prison.
Yeah.
And I don't know if we've ever talked about it publicly, but my children, and under the circumstances, really completed me. And in a psychological sense, I think that I don't think anyone can run from the reality of the fact that they have a loved one who's incarcerated. They confront it in school. They confront it amongst their teachers. They confront it amongst their peers. they experience it in the invitations they receive and they don't receive. You're sending an invitation to the congressman's child, and the congressman's child comes to the birthday party. It's different than sending an invitation to the family with the father in prison. It's different.
We are out of time. What is your... How are you doing? You look good.
I feel great.
Mentally and physically, are you well?
Yeah,
because when you were incarcerated, your physical and mental health were both in doubt.
Yeah.
Are you doing okay?
I was depressed, man. I was down. And my mother's letters helped pull me back from a very dark place.
Physically, you're well, too?
Fantastic. Couldn't be better.
You wrote the introduction to this book, this collection of letters from your mother to you. And at the end of your introduction, you wrote... and of course, her chitterlings, glory be to God. So you wrote about how much you love your mother, and you appreciated that. But then you signed it sincerely, 32453-016. Why did you sign it that way?
That's my number. 32453016 is what we're known as in the system.
I understood that, but you chose not to sign your name there. Instead, you put the number. I wonder why you did that.
In fact, John, I actually considered an autobiography with 32453016 as the number to make the point that men are not just stripped of what they've done wrong, but they're also stripped of their names, they're stripped of their humanity, they're reduced to a number in the system, and I'm going to drive that home in part two of my existence.
Congratulations to both of you in your repaired or even better relationship and in what turned out to be a fun and interesting book on many, many levels. And you've inspired a lot of us, I think, to reconsider connecting with the written word to people that are important to you. This book does that as well.
Thank you.
Yeah,
Barnes and Noble.
Barnes and Noble
is where you can pick this book.
Do you want to sell some books to you?
So
the name of the book is Loving You, Thinking of You, Don't Forget to Pray. You guys are heading over to the Barnes and Noble on Rush?
On Rush and then on Clybourne, just to do a pop-up, sign the books that they have in their inventory. And
shortly,
keep it
like
moving.
In the next hour or so.
In the next 15, 20 minutes maybe.
You're downtown, if not Rush downtown, and pick up the copy of the book and meet these people. Thanks for coming
by.
Thanks for
so
having
much.
Us, and thank you
thank
for the
you.
Interview.
Thinking big thoughts, so you don't have to.
Write a letter.
Here's John Williams.
To your mother, or your kids, or your family, or your friends. It's a lost art. Thank you to Jesse Jackson Jr. and his mother, Jacqueline. This is John Williams. We're in the Allstate Skyline Studio. We're here weekdays 1 to 3, Saturdays 10 to noon on social media. Search WGN King John. Two quick notes here. Before the interview with the Jacksons, we also talked a little bit about the movie Bohemian Rhapsody. Some of you chimed in about movies. 706 says, John and Nick D are very simpatico in their disdain over the Queen bioflick. Nick DiGilio, who you hear overnight on WGN.
That's not true. You mildly didn't like it compared to Nick.
Yeah.
Nick's off the
Nick
off the rails.
Violently hated that movie, I think.
That's why I had asked if it was about knowing the Queen history, because he knows like every bit of Queen and Freddie Mercury and all that.
Well, some of you reminded us, too, that the movie was made by different directors, and it was a complicated, it's a very strange production. I don't care about any of that. All I know is I pays my money, I watch a movie.
Mm-hmm.
And you know what? I'm happy that it's this nice little movie with good music and interesting, relatively interesting characters. Actually, they made the other three members of the band invisible and boring. Maybe they were. And then you have this Freddie Mercury. It's all fine. But it's not the best picture of the year. And it's not one of the eight best pictures of the year. 847 said, did John watch Bohemian Rhapsody at home or at a theater? The two are a different experience. Watched it at home? I'll bet you're right. Hey, John, you should talk to Nick DiGilio about Bohemian Rhapsody. He's got a great take on it, especially forcing a quaint third act. John, did you get to see Black Klansman? Very good. It really is. And I would say Black Klansman, for me, was one of the best movies I saw this year. About writing letters... Some of you said things like this. I did a semester to finish my undergrad away at another university. My now husband wrote me every day, and even when he visited me, he had his sister mail me one so the letters would never stop. 224, John, my 84-year-old dad and a lifelong friend who he recently saw in Southern Illinois exchange letters. It's a lost art. Maybe I'll start one with my daughter. I'm telling you, I was reading this and I thought, I'm going to start to write Grant and Griffin. Even though they live a short walk from my home. I want to do it. Here's the problem. I don't know that they'd read them. I think they go, oh, geez, another letter from Dad. They don't read. They don't read my email.
They call you
back. They call back and say, "I see you left a voicemail."
I know. I know. I go, "Have you listened to it?" No. What did you say? It's on the voicemail. They don't even take the time to read the text above the text. So if I say, the house is on fire, quick call the fire department, and then the next text is, what are you doing Saturday? Their response will be nothing. Cool. Yeah, but the house is on fire. You didn't even read one text above the text. Listen, I'm fine. Don't worry about me. 815 says, read a bunch of letters from my mom over the weekend. She, too, wrote every day when I was in college. I feel so guilty now. I see the pleas for me to write too. Funny what you see at 52 and as a parent that you didn't see as 18 as a kid. 708 says, Jesse, never refuse a kiss from your loving mother. One day you'll regret it. 219, thank you, Mrs. Jackson and son. I needed to hear this interview. I can't wait to read the book. And 773 said, JJ Jr.'s humility is inspiring. Some of you sent us text messages that were not nice, and the Jacksons always inspire their amount of vitriol. I'm not going to share that. I'm not surprised by that either, though. It's 212 on WGN. It's President's Day! And President Thomas Jefferson, the third president of these United States, is on the phone. President Jefferson, this is John Williams. How are you, sir?
A good day to you, my dear citizen.
By the way, speaking of letter writing, we were just sharing, Mr. President, with our listeners the fact that former Congressman Jesse Jackson Jr. and his mother had a letter exchange while he was in jail. You were a great letter writer yourself, were you not?
I was. That was one of the few ways we could communicate in my time. I wrote about 26,000 letters, more probably, but 26,000 have been saved. Beginning when I realized that I was going to be a historical figure, I began keeping copies of all of my letters, which is very tedious business. And when you write the letter and you have to write the copy of it, I eventually had a copying machine that was very, very primitive. But so I wrote letters, and I worked really hard on these letters. I would think about them for quite a while before putting quill to paper.
I didn't think about that. But yeah, if you write a letter and send it off, you don't get to keep the letter. So for you to have a copy of the letter, for you to publish your letters, unless somebody went out and collected them all, and who knows where they went, you have to... Well, I wonder if that changes the authenticity of the exchange then. That is, you aren't writing to me, you're writing to posterity.
Well, to a certain degree, that's true. But I always tried to write for the person who was the recipient. In other words, I slightly adjusted my point of view depending on whether it was a letter to Mr. Madison or a letter to John Adams or a letter to, say, the scientist Joseph Priestley. I kept my core set of values, but I tried always to be thinking of the person at the other end of the ocean or the other end of our colonies, and to shape what I said for maximum persuasion, but also to show real sensitivity to that person's point of view. So it was tedious. I don't think that this really cut into the spontaneity or the authenticity. I wasn't writing for posterity, but I knew at a certain point that inevitably I would be a historical figure, and I said late in life that my biography would probably have to be written from my letters because they were as close to an autobiography as I had produced.
Seems like the Founding Fathers were that way anyway. They had aphorisms and sayings. They would publish their rules to live by. You rewrote the Bible, for crying out loud. And it just seems like many of the Founding Fathers had an eye to the future. I don't think we do that now. We try and hide from our correspondents these days. You all seem to have a different take on that.
Well, we knew that this was a historically important moment. So we broke with Great Britain in 1776, and we created a republic. And really, it was the first republic ever. There had been some approximations in ancient Rome and a few things in the early 17th century in the Low Countries of Europe, but we were really creating the first republic based upon classical principles of separation of powers and checks and balances and trying to give maximum sovereignty to the people and minimal government in order to coordinate their social activities. And so we were aware that the whole world was watching, and not just the whole world was watching, but history was watching. And we were so acutely aware, John, that if we failed, if our experiment collapsed, if somehow we couldn't make a republic work, then the pessimists and the dictators and the tyrants of the world would say, see, we gave it a chance. The Americans tried it. It failed. And therefore, we can stop talking such nonsense and return to more centralized and authoritarian systems of power, which are efficient and which actually do work in the real world. So we weren't quite paranoid about this, but we were certainly aware that if we failed, it would be a setback for the cause of human freedom.
That's a lot to think about. That's a lot on your shoulders, isn't it?
It was. I was pretty sure we were right. You know, the people are sovereign. In a state of nature, without government, you have maximum freedom to do whatever you please. But if you decide, five of you decide to form a little social compact to respect each other's property, to tolerate each other's religious points of view, to tax yourselves on an equitable basis for, say, hiring a tutor for your school children. But once we enter a state of society, we give up some of our full complement of natural rights, but we need to do the least of that. We need to maintain the maximum liberty and freedom that we possibly can with a government that can create a minimal social order. And so we knew that we were right, that this is the only form of government that really can stand the test of reason and equality and the dignity of man. But the question was, are the people up to it? You know, the people are sovereign, but can they actually govern themselves?
Yeah, I'll get to that in just a second. Thomas Jefferson's on the phone. Imagine that. It's 217 on WGN Radio, and Mr. Jefferson is going to be in the Chicago area, and for one of the first time, well, for the first time in a very long time, you know, I like to interview the presidents on stage. Sometimes we interview Teddy Roosevelt. Sometimes it's TJ. We are going to visit with him at the Athenaeum Theater in Chicago. He's going to be in Chicago, the city proper. I could almost walk there from where I live. On May 18th, May 18th, mark that on your calendars. You can't get tickets yet, but you will be able to soon. May 18th. Thomas Jefferson in town. Happy President's Day, by the way, which I think I heard on TV today. In some states, they still call it Washington Day. Is this today Washington Day? So some places call it President's Day, some places call it Washington's Day. I think that's correct.
I've heard that it's Washington's birthday.
Washington's birthday, yeah. You cool with that? Should we have a President's Day? Should we carve out a day and make it a holiday to honor guys like you?
No. Of course not. The president is a public functionary. He's a citizen like other citizens. We don't want to aggrandize this person to make him seem like the monarch of England or the dictator or the priest or the central person in American life. The president should be kept in his place. You know, the first article of the Constitution is about Congress, and only the second article is about the executive, because we had learned the hard way that strong executives can be tyrants. So I didn't ever let people know my birthday. By the way, it's April 13th, but people wanted to have a holiday, and I said, absolutely not. If any president in your history deserves to be remembered with a holiday, it would be George Washington, not only because he saved this country on the field of battle and really set the protocols of the presidency during his two terms as the first president of the United States, and by the way, the only unanimously chosen president in American history, but also because he had a very strong sense of the limits of executive power.
Yeah.
He was always trying to retire. He didn't think of himself as an American king. And so he deserves a special level of respect that I think no other president deserves. And certainly I would not want to be included in a President's Day.
Well, times have changed. Now, you may have a question or comment for President Jefferson. My number is 312-981-7200. There have been a couple of things about the president in the news from a constitutional standpoint that I think, while you didn't author the Constitution, I think your opinion would be most relevant on President Jefferson. So stay right there. 312-981-7200. TJ's on the phone. And if you have a question or comment, we'd love to hear it at WGN. Call me now. Thomas Jefferson, third president of these United States, joins us on WGN Radio. You still there, Mr. Jefferson?
Yes, sir.
By the way, college costs are killing families these days. You know, when I get to be king, I like to say on the radio sometimes, I think that college should be free the same way high school is. What do you think of that, Mr. Jefferson?
Well, I did something called the Bill for the More General Diffusion of Knowledge back in Virginia in the 1770s, and I said that we should have free university fellowships for the very best of our young people, but we should have free public education for all, boys and girls. So a high school degree in my time would have been equivalent to a college degree in yours. That's entirely a state matter, my friend. I think that each state is a laboratory of our democracy, and Virginia might have one approach to this, and your Illinois might have a different approach. I don't see any reason why there should be a single standard in a free society like our own.
Bill wanted to ask you a question. Bill, you're on WGN. Hi.
Hi. I was wondering how Thomas feels about his image being up on Mount Rushmore, and if he doesn't think he belongs there, who should be there?
That's a great question. I would rather that I would not be carved onto a mountain in the Dakotas. I think that creates a sort of false sense of the greatness of our presidents. I think that we must be very careful not to over-aggrandize them and to make them a sort of group of secular saints. And so I would be opposed to my own image there. I think George Washington's might be a good idea. And also, I have to spend eternity next to Theodore Roosevelt, and Roosevelt hated me. Roosevelt said so many nasty things about me in the course of his life that it's very disagreeable. I'm a gentleman, and I don't think that we should ever talk in a vulgar or negative way about other presidents or other political figures.
630 said, President Jefferson, I find it ironic that you're constantly engaging with someone that aspires to be king. I would be a good king, though, just for the record.
Well, I don't know that, but you certainly seem to be a rational human being, and I don't think you do a lot of ad hominem attacks on people who disagree with you. And from the little experience I have in talking with you on stage or hearing you, you often are quite willing to listen to points of view that are not your own and to acknowledge the legitimacy of those points of view, even when you disagree. And I think that's the very basis of a democracy. You know, Voltaire is said to have said, Madam, I disagree with what you say, but I shall defend to the death your right to say it. And I always said to people, we can disagree, but let us disagree as rational friends.
Do you think the president has too much power?
Yes. The Constitution is clear. Congress is to lead. And, you know, you said a moment or two ago about presidential meddling in appropriations and so on. The Founding Fathers, and I was not one of them, I was not in Philadelphia, but they were very clear about this, that all bills involving money had not only to begin in Congress, never the executive, but they had to begin in the House of Representatives, because that's the House, that's the body in Congress that's closest to the people, that's elected every second year. And so they made sure that two things had to begin in the House of Representatives. One was fiscal matters, and the other was war, because those are the two gravest things that a legislative body can do: spend your money, take it out of your pocket and spend it, or to send you or your children into harm's way in war. And so those have to begin in the House.
I understand
the executive can spend money, but they can't generate the spending of money.
In extraordinary times, though, I think you need a general to say, okay, but now I'm just going to lead and you're going to have to trust me on this. And it could be at a time of war or some national health emergency where we don't have time. Let's just get it done. The president is trying to do that with the wall on the southern border.
No, I think you're wrong about this, and now you're revealing your monarchical aspirations. This is something that we would have put in the Constitution had we intended it. In other words, in the Roman Republic, the ancient world, there was a provision for dictatorial powers, that under emergencies they could name a dictator and he would have a year or 2 years or some limited amount of authority, and then that provision would end at the end of the emergency. That was part of their constitution, but the 55 men who made our constitution did not have a provision for emergency or dictatorial powers.
Well, maybe
even
they,
in a time of urgency.
Maybe they hadn't thought about it, or maybe they had. I mean, do you think they contemplated something like this?
Yes, of course. And in fact, in Virginia, we contemplated making our governor a dictator during the darkest period of the Revolutionary War. That would have required a constitutional amendment, and you could amend your constitution in your time. It may be that you've reached the point where you need to tear up the constitution and write one with more executive authority. But until such time, you need to live under the bylaws that you set for yourself, and they make Congress supreme and the executive decidedly subordinate to that.
All right, we'll finish this conversation or really get into it maybe when you're on stage. I think it's – I have very mixed feelings about overturning the will of the people, even if it's Donald Trump. But I think this conversation we're having as a country right now about exploring the 25th Amendment is not an administrative coup. It's in the Constitution now for a reason. It's a process. To explore it isn't a coup. There is a way to remove the president if you think he's incompetent. And to have that conversation cannot be treason. It's an exercise of something that's in the law. Now, you got me all
right. I couldn't agree more. No, I think you're absolutely right, sir, because the amendments to the Constitution have been very few and very far between. So you have made this your fundamental law by way of that amendment. It would not be a coup to use that law in the case of an insane president or one who had become physically incapable or whatever else it might be. But I would just urge everyone as we close to go read about the end of the Roman Republic and the coming of the Roman Empire. They were going through a period very similar to what you are going through when the existing constitution could no longer embrace the real problems of the real world. And that led to a dictatorship and one of the worst periods in human history.
I'm glad you're on Mount Rushmore, sir. You may not be crazy about it, but, you know, if we had to put four of them, I'm glad you're one of them up there.
I've always wanted to see the Great Lakes. I'll see you in May.
Yeah, no kidding. So this conversation or something like it, right? It's what we do on stage, and then you get to ask questions, too. Sometimes it's outright funny, but it's always thoughtful and true. A conversation like this will come your way. What was the date I just said, Producer Elif? May 18th, 10:30, Athenaeum Theater in Chicago. There's a story in the Tribune over the weekend. Aurora shooter should not have had a gun due to felony conviction, but state law failed to stop him. And this is what the author of the article, this is Megan Kripo's story, says. State police regularly check the FOID database to ensure people with cards remain eligible to own a gun. When they find that someone's FOID should be removed, that is, you no longer have the right to own a gun, they send a notice instructing that person to give the card back to local police and turn over their weapons to a law enforcement agency or to someone outside their household who can legally own a weapon. And when I read that, I chuckled. I mean, that's dark. That's not going to happen. These are people who are already breaking the law. And they say, now you got to give us a gun. On the honor system? Are you kidding me? The article continues. And they quote an expert on this who said, that's as far as the state police go in the vast majority of cases because they're not funded to do anything more than that. State law does not specify whether any agency in particular is responsible for finding out whether former FOID card holders are still hanging onto their guns. And by the way, that's at least people who are FOID card members or holders, as opposed to people who never even went through that inconvenience. One of the people quoted in this article is a guy named Mark Jones. He's a senior policy advisor at the Illinois Council Against Handgun Violence. He's in our studio. Mark, welcome to the show.
Thank you, John. It's good to be here.
What's your background?
I'm a 30-year law enforcement veteran. I was a suburban public safety officer in the village of Glencoe for the first 5 years of my career. Often I was called a butler with a gun. Working there.
Nice neighborhood.
It was lovely. I went from there to the Bureau of Diplomatic Security, the United States State Department, where I was a special agent for about 6 years, and then moved on to the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives, where I worked for 20 years, retired as the regional firearms advisor for Central America, living in El Salvador, as a supervisory special agent.
What did you think when you heard this Aurora story?
It's sadly common. We are experiencing these around the country, and it seems like in burgeoning numbers over the last couple of years, the numbers of mass shootings seem to be going up. I think the FBI has documented that. It's an awful tragedy.
Are we doing something wrong?
Yeah, I think the bigger culture of firearms in the United States has been allowed to go along. You know, the last real important law that was passed on the, on this topic was 1968, 51 years ago, the Gun Control Act of 1968, which is the current framework for regulating commerce in firearms in the United States and abroad and enforcing those firearms laws. At the state level, which there are 50 states and 50 sets of state firearms laws, it's a patchwork, a quilt, a pastiche.
Is that why somebody convicted in Mississippi, the people in Illinois don't know about it?
It's entirely possible that this gentleman, whose name I will not mention on your show.
Maybe I should.
It's entirely possible, and this is right now speculation, John. The investigation's ongoing, and I don't know what the authorities know. It's possible that he didn't tell the truth when he applied for his firearms owner's ID card, and there's no fingerprint set up to back that up right now.
Do you think we should be more deliberate in the licensing process?
Well, we allow someone to have a firearms purchase card that's good for 10 years without any set of fingerprints. I think that we could tighten that up, make it a lesser number of years, give people an opportunity to find out if they're doing something wrong more quickly, potentially.
So somebody, say, has a right to own a firearm and does, then they commit a crime for which they should forfeit that right. It sounds like some of that is in play here. Let's just assume for argument's sake that's what happened.
Yes.
What's the mechanism to get the gun away from that person?
Well, as you said, the state police send a letter, and in the letter they attach a form, and the form is required to be filled out and sent back in with the FOID. Once their firearms owner's ID card has been returned, then they're no longer in legal jeopardy. If they fail to return the form, that's a crime. That's a separate crime. It's a misdemeanor, but it's a separate crime. I'm aware that in 2017, the state police revoked 11,000 firearms owners' ID cards, and 4,000 of those revocations sent in their forms.
I was surprised to see that.
Yeah.
I mean, that's less than 50%, but I'm surprised they got 4,000.
Well,
FOID cards, but what about the guns?
Right. And then there really is the rub. There's no specific responsibility assigned for an agency to go out and recover the firearms from someone.
That's nobody's job?
No one specifically enumerated in the law to go and do that.
Who do you think, okay, pause and contemplate that. I mean, that's a weak law. Then.
Yeah.
No, well, yeah. A lot of laws are unenforceable. A lot of bills are unfunded. This is something without an operable mechanism. So somebody's got to go get the gun. So say you have lost your right to own a gun. Can a police officer knock on the door and say, give me your gun?
In theory, I think they could. In fact, that's really, I think, the scheme that's currently in place. The state police make a referral to the local jurisdiction listed on the FOID. If that's still operable, let's say, for example, this fellow moved from the address that's on his FOID that's 10 years old. The cops can go knock on that door all they want. They're never going to find him.
That's not an unreasonable search and seizure or something like that. I mean, I thought you can't just go knock on someone's door.
No, you can go and knock on. If you know that, if you've got a reasonable suspicion that they have a gun in the house that they're not supposed to have, you can go and knock on the door to ask them about it. The problem comes in if they say no. Then you're stuck.
What do you mean no?
All right. So as an example, the Cook County Sheriff's Police have an organized program to recover FOID cards from people who've had them revoked. They get notified of revoked in Cook County. They go knock on doors.
They do.
Their gun team tries to get guns back. They take the FOID back, and then they seek to do what I would refer to as a knock and talkers. Basically, they're trying to get into the home and get the guns back. Many times, the people will be compliant. They don't want to be criminals. They hand their stuff over, and the county goes away. But sometimes, the people say, I don't have those guns anymore. And the county is then stymied. The police cannot go in there unless they have a search warrant, and they don't have sufficient, I don't believe, probable cause based on that current information to get a search warrant.
So all the guy's got to do is say, I don't have it, and now the police probably can't cross the threshold of the door.
Correct. That's exactly right.
Okay. Well,
so then they're stuck, right? So they got to get creative. They do the knock and talks. They get some back. A percentage are going to lie and say they don't have the guns any longer. There's the gap. There's what we need legislation to fix. Or perhaps we need regulation to fix it. The state police are empowered to write regulations about things like this. They could regulate this differently. I'm making it sound like this is a simple, like, wave a wand and fix it. It took us 16 years to get the gun dealer certification law through. So
I imagine that there's some constitutional privacy issues that you're treading on here.
Yeah, we've got a thing called the Fourth Amendment that gets in the way of police just going wherever they want to go and taking whatever they want to take.
Yeah,
it's absolutely true. But I think the bigger issue is at the national level, we have a gun, we have firearms laws that appear strong and are very poorly enforced. That my alma mater, ATF, is kept weak, hobbled, hamstrung by the very Congress that gives them the mission they're supposed to do. They put appropriations riders on them that don't allow them to spend their money in ways that would be useful and even reasonable for and every other federal agency does.
What's an example of what you're talking about?
A gun dealer goes out of business. They're required to send their records to the Bureau. When the Bureau gets the records, they come in, and I'm literally, John, in tractor trailer loads, show up at the National Tracing Center a couple of weeks full of out-of-business records, boxes, paper records. ATF is then not permitted to digitize those records, but instead is required to microfiche them if they want any kind of ability to search them. But mostly they leave them sitting in boxes and containers around the property where the tracing center is.
Why can't they digitize them?
Because the firearms industry has sold the Congress on the idea that if they digitize the records, it's a de facto registration system, and a de facto registration system will immediately lead to confiscation of the firearms. But from law-abiding gun owners will start to lose their firearms if ATF's allowed to have a computerized database of firearms.
Are you serious?
I'm
that's
as serious
the
as a heart attack. There's a great video, and when we're finished with this, you give me your email address, I'll send it to you. You watch this video, and you're going to do a show just about this video. I'll guarantee it. It's all about the tracing center and how they can't do their jobs, and it would be comical if it wasn't so serious.
I will post that on my Facebook page if you give me the link after the show.
Absolutely. I've got it on my phone.
I'm off the air in 11 minutes. In our studio is Mark Jones. He's a senior policy advisor at the Illinois Council Against Handgun Violence. I noticed that you're a council against violence, not against handguns. Is that a distinction you make, or are you against guns, too?
You know, John, I've been shooting since I was 9 years old. I've been a competitive shooter. I've carried a gun professionally for more than 30 years. I'm a hunter and a recreational shooter. I am absolutely the industry's worst enemy, because I'm a man who's worked on the inside of the industry. I know how badly they're manipulating our government and the people of the United States.
The NRA?
The NRA is nothing but a mouthpiece for the firearms industry. I'm talking about the industry writ large. American Outdoor Brands, Vista Outdoor, Ruger, Sturm Ruger. These are the big companies in the firearms industry that drive all of the regulation and enforcement of laws. They're the ones that tell ATF what they can and can't do. They do that through the NRA. And look, this makes ATF sound very bad. The men and women at that bureau work diligently. They work their tails off to do the right thing, and they're just hamstrung. And I know I keep using that word, but it's the best word I can think of. They are unable to do their jobs because the Congress has put them in a trick bag if they do their jobs.
Stay right there. Mark Jones is in our studio. Let's take one quick call before we take our break. Bill, you're on WGN Radio. Hi, you're on the air.
Yeah, he mentioned a minute ago that if the sheriff goes to your house and you confiscate your FOID card and you say you don't have a gun, they can't do anything about it. And why is it then, if they can't do that about guns, and why is it if you're suspected of selling drugs or something like that, they can bust your door down and come in and search your house?
Thank you for that question. I have to tell you, you're talking about two completely different scenarios here. When the police come to your home to execute a search warrant and make a forced entry, they have the backing of a court. They've had their probable cause statement. They've read it to a judge. The judge has approved it and allowed them to, and actually not even allowed them, ordered them to take those actions to recover the evidence of a crime that's occurring in that home. In the case of a sheriff knocking on the door, he is just basically, he's knocking on the door with a specific purpose in mind to get the FOID back, but he has no legal authority to cross the threshold of your home unless you authorize it.
And I wonder, I love the question and I appreciate the answer. I'm on your side, but I can see the problem that would create. If we said, okay, and we're going to empower the cops to literally kick the door off the hinges and run in looking for a gun, and they don't even live there, or they've legally gotten rid of the gun, or whatever,
right.
or people are going to go grab the guns and we're just inviting shootouts. I can just see how different or complicated this scenario is.
Mm-hmm.
Mike, you're on WGN Radio. Hi.
Hi, John. One other inherent problem in the FOID card system in Illinois is that a gun is not linked to the FOID card until you go purchase a gun. Just because someone has a FOID card doesn't mean they have a gun. My own children don't own any guns, yet they all have FOID cards.
Mm-hmm.
But I have a I have guns, but none of my children do. So if my child is on that list of turning your void card, and then they come to their home, they don't have a gun.
What are you hearing here?
I agree completely with the caller. That is an inherent problem, and I don't know that you could necessarily easily tie individual purchases to that specific FOID right now. But we need to tighten these laws up in Illinois and across the country.
You know, it just reminds me a little bit. I'm not in this world. I don't have a FOID card. I don't own a gun. I never have. But for instance, you may be registered to, I'm registered to vote out of state. Mm-hmm. And when they look at the voter registration polls, they go, that guy doesn't live here. There's something afoot. And no, there's nothing afoot. I moved and I didn't alert the state. And so the records don't exactly tell you what you think they might. It sounds like FOID is a little bit the case as well.
Oh, absolutely. Look, as I said, it's a 10-year card. A lot of things happen to people in their lives in 10 years, including felony convictions or other things or moves or, you know, so it's even if you knocked on that door, as I said, they may not be there any longer.
First piece of advice you would have for a legislator in Illinois then about this?
Oh, boy, that's a big one. I've been giving legislators advice for the last 2 years and nobody's listened to me till now. But it's actually... just that we need to examine what we're doing. And the biggest piece is if we're going to pass laws, we have to resource the agencies properly to enforce the law. The state police have not been given all the tools they need thus far by previous administrations to do this work.
Yeah.
And so, you know, that's really I've had meetings in the last week with many, many incoming officials.
Yeah.
And they're all very high on the idea of trying to do this the right way.
Everybody gets religion after one of these shootings. Hopefully they'll maintain their enthusiasm for some sort of sensible reform. Mark Jones from the Illinois Council Against Handgun Violence. Thanks for coming by the studio today.
Thank you for having me, John.
We will post online the video on my Facebook page. I'm WGN King John. We'll post the video you said everybody needs to see about the problem with...
the ATF National Tracing Center.
Yeah, and why it's hard to follow the guns and the person. I'm so glad somebody texted this. Gun violence, now that's our national emergency. How many of us said or heard that over the weekend? Rokan, Anna DeVlantis, ready to roll. Hi, guys.
Thank you very much. Anna's off again today. Richard Roper will be here joining me in just a few minutes. And it's funny, your last guest, really important point, that there are so many gaping holes in the system. And it's designed that way. Legislators around the nation and the state level and at the federal level have been influenced greatly to make sure that this system is not going to take guns away from rightful gun owners, right? There's a lot of people who disagree with the fact that you have to register at all. You should just have a universal right to have a gun. Well, you know, that's a debate that goes on and on and on about the framers of the Constitution. Could they ever have imagined anything other than a single-shot musket?
Bear arms. It's in the Constitution.
Right. But, you know, they couldn't have possibly imagined a nuclear weapon, which we have prohibited. We prohibit fully automatic weapons and things like that. So the question is, where is that side? Everybody understands that debate. But in the meantime, the laws that we have on the books cannot be enforced because there is not a good enough system. You know, in terms of background checks for the concealed carry and for FOID, those go to the county sheriffs first. And then they get the state does the concealed carry. The FOIDs go to the counties. They have no budget for it. They don't have a budget for people going through all the applications, which is how something like this slips through the cracks.
Yeah. He was alluding to some of that, and I know we don't have enough money for the stuff we've already got on our plate, but how is this not something somebody isn't rectifying? How do these different agencies in different states not communicate better? It's insane.
Yeah, it is.
So. Hey, Ro, I'm going to go. You keep doing what you're doing, man.
Thank you very much.
Have a good show.